Welcome back to Mastering Defense Infrastructure, and a special hello to all our DECnet Pro members working through the 30-week course. And of course, a big welcome to everyone tuning in on Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, wherever you're listening. We're glad you're here. I'm Darian Macy, and I'm joined by my co-host, Jessica Bottlebrush. Jess, how are you going?
Hey, Darian, I'm good. Excited for this one. We've been talking a lot about Army and Navy infrastructure lately, but today it's all about the Air Force and how Australia's air bases are being transformed. There's a lot happening, especially with the way the RAF is shifting its posture in response to what's going on in the Indo-Pacific and all the new tech coming online.
Yeah, absolutely. The Air Force posture is really about where and how we position our people and assets to respond to threats and fulfill missions. With the regional security environment getting, well, a bit more tense, and with closer cooperation with our allies, the RAF is putting a lot of focus on strengthening those northern bases and making sure the infrastructure can support the latest aircraft. That's where the National Airfields Capital Works Program, NACW, comes in. It's a bit of a mouthful, but it's basically a rolling multi-base, multi-year program to keep our runways, lighting, and fuel systems up to scratch across the country.
Yeah, and it's not just about building shiny new hangars. NACW is the nuts and bolts stuff. Resurfacing runways, upgrading lighting, fixing drainage, and making sure the airfields can handle everything from heavy transports to fast jets. For example, we've seen recent upgrades at Darwin, Townsville, Curtin, and Learmonth. Each of those bases has had work done under NACW, and it's all about keeping them operational and ready for whatever comes next.
And the way Defence has bundled these works, multi-site packages, often with a single delivery team working across several bases, it's a smart way to get consistency and value for money. We'll dig into some of those case studies in a minute, but the big takeaway is the Air Force is investing heavily to make sure the estate isn't the weak link in our air power. It's a huge opportunity for industry, but also a big challenge given the scale and complexity.
Let's get into some of those big base redevelopments. I think Learmonth is a great place to start. It's one of those bare bases up on the northwest coast, usually pretty quiet, but now it's getting a $662 million upgrade to support the KC-30A tankers. That means strengthening the runway, new taxiways, big new aprons with in-ground hydrant refueling and upgraded lighting. It's a massive transformation, turning Learmonth from a backup strip into a forward operating base for heavy jets.
Yeah, and it's not just about the tankers. By upgrading Learmonth, we're increasing resilience. If the main bases in the east are under threat or just too far away, Learmonth can host and launch tankers or patrol aircraft. And it's being coordinated with the NACW works, so you don't get that duplication of effort. CPB contractors are involved early for constructability advice, which is crucial when you're working around civilian flights and emergency services.
Amberley's another big one. The Growler Phase 6 facilities project is all about supporting the upgraded EA-18G Growlers. So new maintenance and logistics facilities, climate-controlled storage for the next generation jammer pods, and upgraded training spaces. It's a $228 million project, and it's not just at Amberley. There's work at Delamere Air Weapons Range in the NT as well. The key thing is, as the tech evolves, the infrastructure has to keep up. You can't just buy new jammer pods and call it a day. You need the workshops, the secure storage, the training facilities, all of it.
And then there's Richmond, which is getting a near $1 billion redevelopment to support the new C-130J replacement fleet. That's everything from new hangars and maintenance facilities to upgraded accommodation, utilities, and even simulators. Richmond's old hangars are heritage listed, so there's a bit of a dance between modernising and preserving history. Jess, you've had some experience with heritage approvals at Richmond, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. Richmond's hangars are a classic example of the challenges you get with heritage-listed infrastructure. You've got to work closely with heritage consultants, document everything, and sometimes you can only make changes if you preserve certain facades or record the history properly. It's a balancing act, upgrading for new capability while respecting the past. But it's doable, and it's actually pretty rewarding when you see the old and new come together.
It's a good reminder that every base has its own story and every project has its own set of challenges. But the common thread is new platforms drive new infrastructure needs and the estate has to keep evolving to support them. Let's talk about what these new platforms actually need from an infrastructure perspective. Every time the RAF brings in a new aircraft, whether it's the Wedgetail, Poseidon, C-17, Growler, KC-30A, or the new C-130J, there's a whole shopping list of requirements. Hangars, aprons, hydrant refueling, secure shelters, you name it.
Yeah, and while there are some common elements, like every aircraft needs somewhere to park, refuel and get fixed, each platform has its quirks. Take the Wedgetail, for example. It's basically a flying radar, so it needs secure, climate-controlled hangars with advanced comms and power. At Williamtown, they built bespoke hangars with EM shielding and all the ground support gear. The C-17s, on the other hand, are just massive. They need huge hangars, heavy-duty aprons and runways that can handle their weight. Amberley had to build a purpose-built hangar just for the C-17's tail height.
And the KC-30A tankers. Hydrant refueling is a must because you're not just fueling the aircraft, you're uploading fuel to offload to others. That's why Learmonth's upgrade includes in-ground hydrant points. The Growlers, meanwhile, need specialised workshops for their jamming pods, robust power supply in the hangars, and secure storage for classified kit. Amberley's Growler facilities are a good example of how infrastructure has to adapt as the tech evolves. First it was ALQ 99 pods, now it's the next gen jammer, and the facilities have to keep up.
And looking ahead, the new C-130J fleet at Richmond is driving a whole new wave of works. Bigger hangars, new simulators, expanded aprons, and future-proofed utilities. Even if we don't know the exact aircraft model yet, Defence is designing flexible facilities that can handle whatever comes next. It's smart planning, and it means industry needs to be ready to deliver bespoke solutions as new platforms are announced.
So, whether it's hangars, hardstands, hydrant systems, or secure shelters, the infrastructure has to be tailored to the platform. But the big picture is every new capability sends ripples through the estate, and that means a steady pipeline of projects for those who understand the requirements.
Now let's zoom out and look at the bigger strategic drivers. The 2020 Defence Strategic Update and the 2023 Defence Strategic Review both put a huge spotlight on Northern Australia. The idea is posture modernisation, making sure our force laydown matches the current threat environment. That means upgrading key northern bases like Tyndall, Darwin, Learmonth, Curtin and Shergar, and making them more resilient and ready for anything.
Yeah, and resilience is a big theme. We're talking backup power, like the new solar farm at Darwin, hardened shelters, cyclone-resistant designs, and dispersal strategies so we're not putting all our eggs in one basket. The idea is, if one base takes a hit, the others can keep operating. Dispersal also means upgrading bare bases and even looking at civilian airfields for contingency use. It's about making it as hard as possible for an adversary to target our assets.
And you can't forget the environmental and community side. A lot of these bases are in sensitive areas, like Learmonth near Ningaloo, or Darwin with its joint civil-military use. Projects have to manage things like runoff, noise and heritage. Plus, there's a real push for sustainability, with things like LED lighting and solar panels. Community engagement is huge too. Defence works closely with local councils, Indigenous groups and businesses to make sure the benefits flow locally and disruptions are managed.
And estate sustainment is part of it as well. It's not just about building new stuff, but making sure it lasts, using durable materials, standardising components, and planning for through-life support. The goal is to future-proof the estate so it can support whatever missions come next, and do it in a way that's responsible and sustainable. All right, let's get into the nuts and bolts of how these projects actually get delivered. Defence uses a few different delivery models: managing contractor, head contractor, early contractor involvement, and then there's medium works for the smaller jobs. Each has its pros and cons, and it really depends on the size and complexity of the project.
Yeah, and for the big complex projects, like Richmond's redevelopment, a managing contractor model makes sense. The MC comes in early, helps with design, and manages all the subbies. For more straightforward jobs, you might see a head contractor or even a medium works contract, especially for upgrades under $15 million. Early contractor involvement is a feature in both MC and HC models, and it's great for de-risking, getting industry input early so you can plan staging, logistics, and all the tricky bits.
I've actually led early contractor involvement phases on the PDS contract, and I can tell you it makes a huge difference. You get the right people in the room early, you spot risks before they become problems, and you can stage works to minimize disruption. It's not perfect, but it's a lot better than trying to fix things on the fly.
And speaking of risks, procurement in defence is getting more complex. Cybersecurity, ethical compliance, sovereignty concerns, and the old costs versus quality debate. We've seen high-profile IT failures and supply chain disruptions are a real worry. Defence is putting a lot of emphasis on vetting suppliers, prioritising domestic sourcing where possible, and making sure quality isn't sacrificed for cost savings. It's a balancing act, but it's essential for keeping the estate secure and resilient.
For industry, the key is to stay informed. Track tenders on Austender, get involved in industry briefings, and make sure your security clearances and compliance are up to date. And don't overlook the opportunities in Indigenous participation and regional subcontracting. Defence is really pushing for local and Indigenous businesses to get a slice of the action, and it's a win-win for everyone.
Let's talk about the elephant in the room, workforce and delivery challenges, especially up north. The Strategists and SPI have both pointed out that there's a real shortage of skilled labour in northern and western Australia. Defence is competing with other sectors like renewables, roads, even the Olympics in Brisbane for a pretty limited pool of workers. And honestly, a lot of construction firms see defence work as more trouble than it's worth, with all the complex tendering and remote locations.
Yeah, and that's a big risk for project budgets and timelines. In the short term, defence is relying on fly-in, fly-out crews, paying a premium to get people on site for a couple of weeks at a time. They're also trying to reduce procurement hurdles for lower risk works, so more contractors can get involved. But that's not a long-term fix.
Longer term, the answer is more about strategic partnerships and clear pipeline planning. If industry knows what's coming up and when, they can invest in local capacity and training. There's also a big push for Indigenous participation and local hiring, getting people from the region involved, not just flying in crews from the cities. It's about building a sustainable workforce, not just ticking boxes for the next project.
And it's not just about defence either. The states, local governments and industry groups all need to work together to plan the social infrastructure, housing, schools, services that supports both the ADF and the construction workforce. Otherwise, we'll keep running into the same bottlenecks and projects will keep missing their targets or blowing out costs. All right, let's wrap up with a look at the big picture, securing the homeland. The latest report from Strategic Analysis Australia really doesn't pull any punches. Australia's geography no longer protects us from long-range threats. Our bases, and even our civilian infrastructure, are vulnerable to missile and drone strikes. So what do we do about it?
The report's pretty clear. We need to shift from just making bases more comfortable to actually hardening them, protecting key assets from attack. That means more hardened shelters, better base defences, and crucially, integrating civilian infrastructure into our defence plans. Think dual-use ports, airfields, and expanded fuel storage at key northern bases and even civilian facilities. If we ever have to disperse, we need to be able to use those assets seamlessly.
Yeah, and there's a real tension between habitability and survivability. It's great to have modern, comfortable facilities, but if they can't withstand a missile strike, we're missing the point. The report calls for a shift in priorities, more investment in hardening, more focus on fuel storage and supply chains, and a real partnership with civilian operators. It's not just about the military anymore. It's about the whole national infrastructure being ready for a crisis.
And that's a big challenge for future investments. How do we balance making bases livable for our people with making them survivable in a conflict? What would actually shift the priorities? Would it take a real crisis, or can we get ahead of the curve? It's a conversation that's only going to get more important as the threat environment evolves.
Absolutely. And that's where we'll leave it for today. There's a lot to think about, whether you're in industry, defence, or just interested in how Australia is preparing for the future. Jess, thanks for another great chat.
Thanks, Darian. Always a pleasure. And thanks to everyone for listening, whether you're a DECnet Pro member or just tuning in for the first time. We'll be back next week to dive into joint and space programs, so stay tuned. Take care, Darian.
You too, Jess. And thanks, everyone. See you next time on Mastering Defence Infrastructure.